They passed an ordinance in the town. They said we'd have to tear it down. That little old shack out back, so dear to me. Though the health department said its day was over and dead, it will stand forever in my memory. Don't let them tear that little brown building down. Don't let them tear that precious building down. Don't let them tear that little brown building down, for there's not another like it in the country or the town. It was not so long ago that I went tripping through the snow out to that house behind my old hound dog, where I'd sit me down to rest like a snowbird on his nest and read the Sears and Roebuck catalog. I would hum a happy tune, peeping through the quarter moon, as my daddy's kin had done before. It was in that quiet spot daily cares could be forgot. It gave the same relief to rich and poor. Don't let them tear that little brown building down. Don't let them tear that precious building down. Don't let them tear that dear old building down, for there's not another like it in the country or the town. It was not a castle fair, but I could dream a future there and build my castles to the yellow jacket's drone. I could orbit around the sun, fight with General Washington, or be a king upon a golden throne. Now, he's seen one of them, I know. It wasn't fancy built at all. We had newspapers on the wall. It was air-conditioned in the winter time. It was just a humble hut, but its door was never shut, and a man could get inside without a dime. Don't let them tear that little brown building down. Don't let them tear that precious building down. Don't let them tear that dear old building down, for there's not another like it in the country or the
There goes Billy Ed Wheeler with one of my favorite songs. That's been, I think that, I think I bought that record about 30 years ago at least. I think it was came out in the 60s, I think. Billy Ed Wheeler, he's done a lot of funny stuff. Yeah, he has. Well, we get so much of that caca coming through here on the internet, I just got to play that little old outhouse song once in a while because it fits with all the news we're running through here. Terrible Tommy in the bunker right next to Terrible Tommy's Terrible Tavern and Steakhouse and Filling Station, where we pump only ethyl and regular, and now it's back down to 10 cents a gallon because the oil's going down, 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 and we get a little boost once in a while with a tanker that Mr. Putin sends over to us. He's a nice guy. And we're out there working hard in the barn on the used equipment, weapons of mass destruction, used equipment stuff that we're bringing in here from all over the place. Man, the U.S. government's throwing that stuff all over. A lot of it's still in the packing crates, man. And it's hard for us to get enough Chinese junks to go over there and pick that shit up and bring it back over here. But, of course, a lot of it's brand new, so we don't have to work on it. We'll be back in business in the spring. We'll open up the gates here in April, okay? And you can bring your 18-wheelers down here and load up with your weapon of mass destruction choice. And then decide on where you're going to be the most offensive. Yeah, right. We're at P.O. Box 401, Warsaw, Indiana, 46581. And that's the place where you send in your donations for the radio show. And remember, we always like to get them in here before the 15th. And technically, we've said after the 15th, we'd cut you off. We're not real strict on that, but we would appreciate getting it in here between the 1st and the 15th. So we'll be waiting out there at the mailbox in the snow for it to come in. And a webmaster tells me we've got more and more stuff going up there. We're gradually getting that good stuff up there, and we're starting to run all kinds of stuff, and we're dumping some stuff. Some stuff that was just too much right wing for me. And we dumped the cartoons. Christ, those cartoons have been up there for 25 years or better. And if you don't have those cartoons by now, they're all over the internet, all over the world. Everybody's using A. Wyatt Man cartoons. Yeah. So we're not gonna have them on the site anymore. No. Unfortunately, that tends to attract, in many cases, people who are not on the bright side of life. I mean, you know, we can have a little fun and laugh, but if we spend too much time just looking at caricatures of these Africans and so forth, well, I think that's sending sort of the wrong message to the young people. Even though I get a big laugh out of them, there's no cartoons any better than A. Wyatt, man. So anyhow, that's the way it goes. We've had them up there for, what, 25, 30 years. I think that's about enough. Besides, we don't want to offend anybody. Well, I see that boys down there in Mohammed Land have tried to sneak in 52 tons of guns and ammo into Europe following the immigrants in a big 40-foot double containers, followed the migrants to Europe pretending to be furniture, but was discovered by the Greek border securities in 14 containers. Well, you consider a lot more of those. Now, what I would advocate is that the true white fighters in Europe that want to protect Europe for the white race get some spies in there and find out when that stuff's coming through, and you waylay it and put it over in your cave. Yeah, right. Because you're going to need them. You're going to need them, and you know your governments won't let you have them legitimately because they wouldn't want you to hurt a Muslim. And, of course, most of the Christians wouldn't want you to hurt a Muslim, baby. Well, it's strictly might is right. If the Muslims, now the white people of Europe, the white people of America, the white people of South Africa, they're sure finding out that the nigger president spent $23 million on his little ranch with swimming pools and everything else. You know, you had to know what was coming. You didn't do a goddamn thing. It didn't support the people who wanted to do something. All you have to do is go back to, let's see, what year was it here? This book in my library. Let's see, when was this printed? Let's see here. Of course, Solzhenitsyn told you too. I don't have the date on this, but it was in the 70s this came out. It's called The Camp of the Saints by Jean Raspail, and it was translated by Norman Shapiro. It laid it all out in the Camp of the Saints what was going to happen. And we said back then, oh, well, it'll be a long time. Well, it was quite a long time, but not long enough. The battle plan was there that the Third World was going to invade the European continent, and ultimately, too, we've been warned by Thomas Chittum in his great book, Civil War II, about the invasion by the Mexicans and so forth. So white people of America and Europe have no excuse whatsoever. And if you lay your gold out on the street in front of your house, you can be damn sure that somebody's going to come along and pick it up. So I don't sympathize with people anymore. I sympathize with our people, our soldiers, our political people, our lone wolves. I don't sympathize with any of the rest of them anymore. They're getting what they got have coming. Unfortunately, we got to suffer in it with it too before they finally maybe get their head screwed on straight and do something and clean house and kick anybody's ass, even white people that are in the way. That's the only way it's going to be done. And quit fooling around with political parties and all that bullshit. And quit fooling around with spooks in the sky and get down to business. That's the only way it's going to change. But you got no excuse, white man. No excuse whatsoever. You've been told it was coming decades and decades ago. Wait a minute here. I got a stuck. So they're all in shock about, 40 tons or 52 tons of guns and ammo being smuggled into Europe. Shock. What should be done is they should be taken off the people who took them off the Muslims and not let the government take them and just chop them up and throw them away. But that's not going to happen, so we'll just sit here and... Yeah, I had a guy send me, one of our friends from Florida, sent me a big old Havana cigar. Yeah, Havana cigar. I haven't smoked for a long time, and I haven't even smoked a cigar for quite a long time, but I got to sit down one of these days and smoke that big sucker, because I like a good cigar, but I don't want to get back into the smoking drag, you know. And nothing's going to change either until you quit bombing the shit out of those people down there. You know, all those countries, they've bombed them over and over and over and over again. Finally, the Canadian says, I think we've bombed them enough. There's not much left to bomb, you know. Can't understand why they're streaming across the Mediterranean. Why their countries are beautiful countries down there in the Middle East. Well, they were once. Now they're nothing but a pile of rubble. So are we getting what we be paid for? Well, some could say that, I would say. Going to be interesting what happens in the campaign, the election down there in, North Carolina or South Carolina? I forget which are they going to next. Because the southern part of the state or the northern part of the state, one of the two, is full of government employees and military people. A lot of military stuff down there. So it's going to be interesting to see how they go. Will they go for Trump or they go for some, more laid-back candidate, more moderate, you know? It's going to be interesting. And I don't know. There are not many hillbillies down there anymore. You know they're going to go for Trump just because they want to see a lot of hell raising. So do I. Okay? So I guess that makes me a hillbilly. Anyhow, don't be shocked. If you got some value in a country, in fact, the only countries that don't get invaded are countries that have nothing there. So if you've got something of value in a country and you're not going to defend it, they're going to take it. That's just the history of man. Remember that. Well, I see Ted Nugent's got his ass in a sling. He better watch out now. The National Rifle Association come under increasing pressure Tuesday to distance itself from longtime NRA board member Ted Nugent. Well, they're going to can his ass after he posted photos of prominent Jewish Americans who he claimed were really behind gun control. Well, I don't know any more than anybody else. There's plenty of non-Jews that are behind it. The photos are overlaid with Israeli flags and anti-Jew labels. For instance, the image of the late Senator Frank Lautenberg, Democrat, New Jersey, is captioned, "Gave Russian Jew immigrants your tax money." Well, they did. While former New York Mayor Michael Bloomberg is tagged as a Jew York City mayor, which he is, why isn't he proud of it? Hell yes, I'm a kike and I'm proud of it. Mikey Bloomberg, nanny state troublemaker and 9/11 Israeli agent. The post appeared on the Aging Rockers. Isn't that interesting how they call him an aging rocker? Facebook page on Monday, according to the Anti-Defecation League of B'nai B'rith, which is the brains of the outfit. The same hateful image has been circulated on anti-Jew and neo-Nazi websites for some time. Nugent's post and his accompanying rant are now drawing greater attention to it. Well, I say if you're going to go after people that are going after the guns, go after every goddamn one of them, whether they're Jew or not. We know that there are plenty of Jews involved in bad activity, and we should be right out in the open by saying there's Jews causing trouble, but then also say there's Judaized Christians causing trouble, and there's humanist people causing trouble, and atheist people causing trouble. Let's nail them all, baby. But Ted, bye-bye. You can't trust the National Rifle Association? No way. Their allegiance is to gun manufacturing and guns for the military and so forth. I've been anti-NRA since early 1970s. That's why we formed the National Association to Keep and Bear Arms, NACBA. Yeah, I don't think it's around anymore, but don't trust the NRA, I'll tell you that, and Ted Nugent's going to find out. Because you can criticize anybody else and call anybody bad names you want, but do not insult a Jew. Or at least a big-shot Jew. You can insult working-class Jews. They get insulted all the time. But the progressives, whether they're Jew or not, have been after him for a long time. Yeah, and that Huffington Post, that bitch, I don't think she's a Jew. You know, she came over here from Hungary or some damn place in Eastern Europe, I guess it was. Married Huffington, had a lot of money. He ran for, what did he run for, governor, or was going to run for president or something a couple of decades ago? Well, she took him for a wad of money and then went off on her own, and now she's acting like she's one of the founding mothers. And she's a bitch, that Huffington Post. She is a total first-class bitch, whether she's a Jew or not. Well, let's see how much of our environment is being screwed up this time.
Arnie Gunderson, thank you so much for joining us this morning. I appreciate that.
Yeah, hi, Michael. Thank you for having me.
So, Arnie, let's jump right in. Mr. Gunderson, let's jump right into this. What has happened at Indian Point? The governor, Andrew Cuomo, is quite concerned, as I'm sure that he should be, as to what happened at Indian Point and how much jeopardy is the community in because of this.
Well, thank you, by the way, for that tip to Robert Knight. You know, he and I talked about these leaks at Indian Point back years ago. Mm. The site is riddled with radioactive leaks, and the Department of Environmental Conservation has known about those leaks for, oh, God, probably at least a decade, if not more. So what has happened is that the monitoring wells on site suddenly registered a very high spike in radiation this weekend. And to put the number in perspective, they talk about 8 million becquerels per liter. What the heck does that mean? You know, a liter bottle of soda. Well, if you envision a liter bottle of soda with 8 million sparks of light every second, that's how many radioactive molecules are disintegrating inside that liter bottle of water. So if that liter bottle of water was in you, those disintegrations would be damaging DNA. So radiation is dangerous, and these numbers, 8 million becquerels per liter, that's 1,000 times higher than the EPA limits, which are themselves much higher than other nations around the world. So it's bad, but we shouldn't be surprised. You know, the site has known it's got leaks for, oh, as long as 20 years now.
Mm. The governor, as I mentioned, said that New York will investigate Indian Point after he learned that radioactive tritium contaminated water leaked into the groundwater at the facility in Westchester County. First, can you just tell us what tritium is, a radioactive tritium is, and what its effects may be.
Yeah. Hopefully radioactive tritium. Tritium is just like water. It's a radioactive hydrogen molecule. So where water goes in your body, tritium goes in your body. Your body doesn't differentiate chemically between it and water. So it's nasty because it's absorbed when you drink or even when you breathe, and it goes right into your cells, crosses the placental barrier, shows up in mother's milk. So it goes wherever there's water in your body. And like I said, it's radioactive and damages DNA.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, the governor said it's radioactive tritium. There may be other isotopes in it as well. And we know on Indian Point there's something called strontium, and that's a bone seeker that causes leukemia. So hopefully it's a single isotope leak, which would be tritium. And my guess is the problem's going to get worse before it gets better.
Mm-hmm. Now, the spokesperson for Entergy, I believe Jerry Nappi, said that the elevated levels of tritium are more than 1,000 times below federal limits and that there are no health risks to the public. Drinking water sources were not effective. Now, Arnie Gunderson, you've been following Indian Point for many, many years. You have extensive knowledge in this area. Is this borne out by the facts, what the spokesperson for Entergy is saying?
You know, Entergy has tried to downplay these leaks wherever they occur. And Entergy plants seem to have a huge number of tritium leaks compared to industry averages. The first thing is Entergy believes that dilution is the solution to pollution. So they're not really talking about in that particular monitoring well, because what they'll say is, well, you don't drink the water that comes from our monitoring well. Let's go out into the middle of the Hudson River and measure it and see what the levels are. So I think the Entergy spokesman is talking about, so far it hasn't reached the Hudson River, but as it migrates toward the river from the power plant, 8 million becquerels per liter is 1,000 times higher than the EPA limits, which are in excess of 800 becquerels per liter.
This latest leak at Indian Point, is this, should we be really seriously concerned about this from the standpoint that this is an old facility?
You know, it's actually both of those. That's a really good point. You know, we had leaks here in Vermont at Vermont Yankee, and when Entergy went in to try to find the leak, they realized there's about 40 pipes underground that they didn't even know about. So these old facilities, when these pipes were built, they didn't put them on the drawings accurately. So the aging issue at Indian Point, you know, it's already over 40 years old. You've got iron pipes in the ground for 40 plus years, and Entergy wants to run it another 20. I think these trends will become worse over time if Indian Point's allowed to run. The second half of your question about should the community be concerned, there's two issues. A new leak. This is a leak that was just detected.
Mm.
And these things tend to get worse before they get better. My guess is when they check that well this week, it'll be higher. That's the trend that happens at every nuke. So the groundwater on that site is going to be contaminated for a couple hundred years. And if you want to recover that site, when the plant is ultimately destroyed and dismantled, if you want to recover that site for other uses, you've got contaminated groundwater to deal with. It happened at Connecticut Yankee, which is on the Connecticut River just south of Middletown, Connecticut. And they had a leak that entered groundwater, and they had to spend an extra $500 million cleaning it up. So if nothing else, forget the health issues, the cleanup issues when you have these types of leaks add to the price that New Yorkers are going to have to pay to clean this mess up.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Well, Arne Gundersen, I appreciate your time this morning. Before you go, I...
Just in case you wondered, that nuclear plant is 38 miles north of New York City. Yeah, New York City's downstream. We don't have to... Nobody has to attack this country. It'll destroy itself. Well, we're going to delve into our history a little bit today out of the library. I'm sure it's a book you've never heard of before. It's called The Lost Tribes and Promised Lands. How about that? I think you might find this interesting. Might step on a few toes over in the Kingdom Identity area, but I'm sorry. Let's see what it has to say. In September 1644, a Portuguese Marano named, and a Marano, of course, is a Jew that's transferred to Christianity. His name was Antonio de Mendocinos, arrived in Amsterdam after having lived for some years in South America, and proceeded to tell the leaders of the recently established Jewish community in Amsterdam. There, he told them a story that caused them to think him as a latter-day Eldad the Danite. 2.5 years before, he told them, while traveling in the wild mountains of Quito, Ecuador, he had heard some of his Indian guides remark that the natives of the country deserved all the suffering they had undergone at the hands of the Spaniards. When he asked them to explain why they thought such a thing, they had replied mysteriously that it was because, quote, we so badly treated a holy people, the greatest in the world, unquote. Nothing more had been offered by them on this point, but later in the same conversation, Francisco, one of the Indian guides, had declared that his countrymen would be avenged upon the Spaniards in time anyhow, quote, by means of the people now hidden, unquote. The two references apparently were to the same people, but Montesino, not seeing their full meaning at the moment, had put the whole matter out of mind for the time being. Upon his return to Cartagena, the Judaizing Mestizinos had found himself accused by Inquisition and put in prison. Praying for salvation in his cell one day, he recited what was by then the standard form of among New World Marano Jews. Blessed be the name of the Lord, who has not made me an idolater, a barbarian, a Negro, an Indian, unquote. When suddenly he stopped, quote, those Indians, he told himself, they're Hebrews, unquote. Pondering his thought incredulously and yet with growing conviction, he resolved that if he ever was released, he would seek out the Indian Francisco and try to learn the truth. Mendocino's story, unclear as to the circumstances of his incarceration, is equally unclear as to those of his release. But released he was, and he immediately went to Francisco, revealing himself as a Jew. Mendocino proclaimed his conviction that Francisco's hidden people were the same race as he. Would Francisco lead him to them? The two men were soon back in the rugged mountains in which Francisco had made his initial revelation, marching relentlessly for a week before they finally came to a halt. It was a Saturday. Montezinos makes a point of telling us they had come to a river, quote, larger than the Dinheiro, unquote. Are there echoes of the Sambatyan in all this? Quote, yes, here. Francisco announced, is where your brothers will be seen. Waving a banner high in the air, the Indian guide soon was greeted by a puff of smoke far beyond the other bank of the river. In response to his signal, the two men waited. Eventually, a canoe appeared, bearing three men and a woman, all of them Indians. actually not Indians, Mongoloids, to the place where Francisco and Montezinos were standing at the water's edge. The woman got off and spoke to Francisco in an Indian tongue that Montezinos could not understand, although he could perceive that he was being identified in the conversation. She then turned to her male companions to explain the situation. Upon hearing her words, they rose, went over to the Montezinos, and to utter astonishment said, quote, Shema Yazriel Adonai Elohini Adonai Ehad. Quote, Hear, O Israel, the Lord your God, Lord is one, unquote. They had recited in Hebrew the fundamental credo of Judaism. Surprise, surprise. A brief conversation then ensued in their common ancestral tongue, according to Montezino, whose fluency in it is almost as perplexing to the reader as his narrative, as it, that of his three mysterious new companions. They told him that they were themselves from the tribe of Reuben and the tribe of Joseph, living on an island nearby. The day went when they were at last to issue forth into the world was coming soon, they explained. But in the meantime, they could not allow visitors to cross over to them. They were willing to make an exception in the near future, however, on account of their need for education, for though they spoke Hebrew, they could not read or write it. Would Menazinos teach them 12 bearded men to be their teachers? He said he would. The four strangers returned to their canoes and paddled back across the river and disappeared from view. Francisco told Menazinos all he knew about these people from his own traditions, his ancestors, to their eternal shame, had indeed made war on them and persecuted them. Only the sorcerers of his tribe had perceived that they were a special people, had been given warning that they should be left alone. Quote, the God of these children of Israel is the true God, unquote, they had said. And everything inscribed on their tablets is true. At the end of the days, they will be lords of all the nations of the earth. One nation will be come bringing many things to this land, and after we have all been provided for, these children of Israel will go forth from where they now are and reign over the whole earth, as they once did, unquote. With this final flourish, Menazino had turned his tale of the lost tribes into a bit of propaganda for the Dutch conquest of Brazil at the same time. The story was received with enthusiasm by Jews of Amsterdam, above all Rabbi Manasseh ben Israel, one of the most prominent and representative men among them. The Netherlands had its Jews had come out from under the Iberian yoke towards the end of the last century and had embraced one another in the cause of repudiating it. And now the Eighty Years' War against Spain in a blaze of triumph. The Jewish community of Amsterdam, which had responded to the most tolerant religious climate in Europe by throwing off its Moreno cover in 1596, was emerging as the most brilliant and influential in world Jewry. Manasseh ben Israel was the son of a Moreno parents who had lived in Portugal, then Spain, then in Madeira Islands, where he had been born in 1604 under the Christian name of Manuel de Sorolhos. From there, the family moved to La Rochelle, a city not far from the Madeiras by dint of commerce as well as geography, but where the predominance of the Huguenots held out the promise of a greater religious toleration by this time. However, it was evidence that the Netherlands were the only country in northwestern Europe where one could be openly professing Jew and still flourish. And it was to Amsterdam that the Sorolhos moved while Emmanuel was still a small child. There, the father and his two sons underwent circumcision, ouch, and charged their names officially to Ben Israel, a Hebrew designation so conventional as to be nearly anonymous. Be patient, I'm getting to it. I got several pages, at least until it emerged as a virtual title for the son who became the most famous Jew of his day. Pursuing another convention, this time biblical, the father named him Joseph and his two sons Ephraim and Manasseh. They probably had already borne all these names in secret during the Moreno days. The former Morenos, who established the Amsterdam community, had followed a tradition of recent times and invited learned rabbis from Jewish communities that had never left the fold to be their teachers and religious leaders. Consequently, the time young Manasseh went to school, Amsterdam Jewry had developed into a splendid Jewish educational system presided over by Sephardic rabbis from North Africa and Ashkenazi rabbis from Central and Eastern Europe. Under this tutelage, Manasseh flourished, becoming an outstanding Hebraist, though never precisely the master of Talmud that one can be only by imbibing it with mother's milk. But what he had was sufficient to advance his star rapidity. The Portuguese part of the community was so delighted at this first appearance of a Jewish scholar from their own ranks that he was quickly accorded an important place in the learned hierarchy. At the age of 17, he was appointed as a Hebrew teacher and published his first book, a grammatical work. Success manifested itself in other ways, too. At 19, he married Avranal, a daughter of a family that boasted Queen Isabella's minister Don Isaac Avranal as one of its ancestors. Still one of the most distinguished lineages of Sephardic Jewry, and several cuts above Manasseh's own. In 1639, when the various congregations of Amsterdam Jewry finally combined into a single one and began laying the groundwork for the great synagogue known to later generations, Manasseh was appointed to the third position in its rabbinical hierarchy. One of Manasseh's sideline business activities was the printing press. Start printed money right away. And with it, he published a number of his own works in Latin and in Spanish, this language still being the standard vernacular of Sephardic Jews everywhere, that were now beginning to reach an audience outside the Netherlands of Christians as well as Jews. Uh-oh. In particular, his book Conciliator, an effort to reconcile all conflicting passages of the Old Testament, and written in Spanish, had a special appeal for the growing number of learned Protestants in Northern Europe and in Britain, among whom Hebrew studies were an endeavor of fundamental religious significance. You see? See how far back this bullshit started? Such men were eager to obtain the rabbinical viewpoint of Old Testament questions, and Manasseh, part Christian himself, by upbringing and not so steeped in the Talmud as to have a religious sensibility alien to the kind of biblical issues of which non-Jews were concerned, was an almost ideal fulfillment of their wishes. Having a popularized turn of mind and being the best known and most personable Jewish scholar in the city that was now a cynosure for Protestants from all over Europe. Going to go to kneel at his feet and learn from the Jew. Manasseh became an apostle to the Gentiles, a sort of Nathan the wise of his day, eagerly sought out in letters or in person by Christians searching for religious truths. There you go. Englishmen in particular were drawn to him, but he was not without honor in his own country either. Rembrandt illustrated one of his books. in the month and years following the appearance of Montezini in 1644 and his disappearance from history immediately thereafter, Manasseh ben Israel became his story's chief enthusiast. More and more of Manasseh's correspondence and conversation was to be devoted to it and to its eschatological implications, and in the late 1640s, both Jews and Protestants were particularly sensitive to these implications. It was a time of theological anguish and millennial expectation. Some Jewish calculators had appointed 1648 as a messianic year, and since that proved to be the year in which the protracted horrors of the Thirty Years' War came to an end, and in which the Second Civil War broke out in England, culminating in the execution of Charles I, many Protestants, especially in England, where the Fifth Monarchy sect was at its height, were convinced that they had indeed entered an apocalyptic time. Something like apocalypse certainly struck for the Jews that year when the Hetman Bogdan Chmielewski led his Cossack followers in a revolt against the Polish overlordship that turned its severest attacks upon the Jews of Eastern Europe, bringing rape, injury, and violent death to tens of thousands, and all but extinguishing the hitherto brilliant light of Polish Jewry. So Hitler wasn't the first. Also in that year, as if it was response to this disaster, a young Jew of Smyrna in Turkey announced to a startled congregation that he was the Messiah. And though it was to be some time before many would take Sabbati Zevi's claim seriously, he was eventually to be the leader of a movement that would send shockwaves through all world Jewry. And the year Sabbati's followers chose for his messianship was 1666, was one that Christian calculators had chosen for the second coming. The idea now being popularized by Manasseh ben Israel that the lost tribes were to be found in the New World among other places, and that they were getting ready for their appearance in the imminent final days, was bound to be the particular appeal to English Puritanism that not only was reaching a hysterical pitch, but was keenly aware of its own special relationship with the American continent. It was an English chaplain residing in The Hague, John Dury, who first began spreading Manasseh's new theories among his countrymen, one of whom, Thomas Thorogood, a clergyman in England, soon was relaying them to friends both at home and in the New World. By this means, they reached the Reverend John Eliot, minister of the town of Roxbury in Massachusetts Bay, who had begun to do missionary work among the Indians in 1646. A true disciple of Roger Williams in that respect, Eliot, a Cambridge graduate who had come to Massachusetts in 1631 at the age of 27, was now learning the Algonquin language as part of his efforts to bring the Christian message to the Mongoloid natives of the area at last, a calling to which the Puritans had been notoriously slow to respond. Eliot probably had already begun to suspect that there were Hebrew elements in the Indians. But Thorogood's correspondence to him on the subject of Manasseh's ideas provided certainly that led him to see millennial significance in his mission. Writing shortly after Eliot's death in 1690, Cotton Mather, an admirer of the man but not his intellect, was to say mockingly that the minister of Roxbury saw some learned men looking for lost Israelites among the Indians in America, and counting that they had thorough good reasons for doing so. and a few small arguments, or indeed, but conjectures meeting with the favorable disposition of the hearer, will carry some conviction with them, especially if a report of a Manasseh ben Israel be back to them. But Mather certainly recognized the power of a vision that eventually enabled Eliot to translate the entire Bible into the Algonquin Indian Mongoloid tongue, a great though inevitable obscure effort of early American literature, which surely reflects on every page of Eliot's sense of the deep-lying affinities between the Mongoloid and language and the Hebrew, between the Indian Mongoloid and the Jewish spirits. So you see where we're going with this, don't you? You know, when I attacked Christianity, finally figured it out, it's because they, all the time and all the way, all down through history, they've been screwing the race. Only rarely did they really support the race. Most of that was the wealthy classes of the white race. This mood at its height is vividly conveyed in a pamphlet describing Eliot's activities that was written in London in 1649 by our old friend Edward Winslow, who had arrived there 3 years earlier on a mission for the recently organized New England Confederation. See, before we could even get off the ground in this country, the Christian religion took over again. I mean, we've never been free of it. There are two great questions, Winslow writes in his preface, which have much troubled ancient and modern writers and men of greatest depth and ability to resolve. The first, what became of the 10 tribes of Israel? To wit, most people that had a brain would say, who gives a shit? The second is, what family, tribe, kindred, or people it was that first planted and afterwards filled that vast and long unknown country of America. Winslow, who does not seem to have been troubled his thoughts with such questions back in Plymouth's early days, now not only ponders them but believes he has the answer. Quote, a godly minister of this city, unquote. He goes on, probably referring to Thorogood, has written to Rabbi Ben Israel, a great doctor of the Jews, now living in Amsterdam, to know whether, after all their labors and travels, the most diligent inquiry, they did yet know what was to become of the 10 tribes of Israel. Manasseh had answered that at least some of them were in the Americas, and Winslow, who had himself often observed customs among the Indians of a purportedly Judaic character, I guess they wore those beanies, huh? Such as rigid... Maybe that's why they cut the hair off, why they scalped white people. That's where that yarmulke was supposed to go. And since they didn't have a yarmulke, they just scalped the white person, and they had that bare skin on top. I have found it out, man. Such as the rigid separation of women during their menstrual periods, was now convinced that this was so, especially considering the juncture of the time wherein God hath opened the Indians, Mongoloids' hearts to entertain the gospel, being so nigh the very years in which many eminent and learned divines had from scripture grounds foretold the conversion of the Jews. The apocalyptic view expressed here is most dramatically emphasized in the postscript of the pamphlet in which one J.D., probably John Dow, name, one of the parliamentary supporters of the Society of Propaganda of the Gospel, writes, quote, it is an expectation of some of the wisest Jews now living that about the year 1650, either we Christians shall be Mosaic, or else themselves Jews shall be Christians. One of the two. Was Manasseh one of the wise Jews who had dropped this idea in the midst of some euphoric conversation? He certainly had felt that the English Puritans' excitement by now, as in letter he received from a minister named Nathaniel Holmes, who promised to write a book declaring the millennium was at hand and the Jews were about to have a central role in it. This alone must have made it seem high time to Manassas that he round up and publish his ideas on the subject in a single book. But literary provocation was added to the millennium by publication in 1650 of Thorogood's book, Jews in America, or Probabilities That Those Indians Are Jews. The Mongoloids are Jews. I ran into Jews in Japan, Hebrews in Japan when I was over there. I never went to one of their get-togethers, but the Japanese Nazis told me about them. Everybody wants to be a Jew. This was full of Manasseh's name and ideas, and so the world was now ready for the rabbi himself. Now, who in the hell would really, who would want to be a Jew, man? Every time they turn around, somebody's kicking their ass. Manasseh published his Hope of Israel the same year in simultaneous Latin and Spanish editions. In true rabbinical fashion, the book is, in effect, a text with commentary, the text being Mendocino's deposition before the Jewish leaders of Amsterdam, with which the book begins, and the commentary being Manasseh's learned and philosophical development of its implications. Manasseh begins the letter with a discussion of the various current theories on the origins of the American Mongols, and rejects all of them but the one maintaining that they had come from Tartary over an ancient land bridge now covered by the Strait of Anian, a vague term in use then, long before the Bering Strait had become clearly known and named, or the narrow body of water conceived to be separating the extreme of Asia from North America. In effect, this theory on the fundamental point was the same as the one most widely held today, except that the latter places the migration across the strait much earlier than he did. Manasseh, of course, considered the migration to have occurred somewhat after the Assyrian conquest of Northern Kingdom of Israel and the disposition of his 10 tribes. But on the other hand, he does not think that the migrants consisted exclusively of their descendants, and in this respect his theory touches once again upon the modern one. For he maintains that the most of the migrants were pure Tartars, and it is his belief that the ancestral tradition described by the Indian guide Francisco refers to an ancient persecution by the Tartars of the Jewish tribes in their midst. But the 10 tribes remain Manasseh's principal concern, and his discussion now focuses upon them, pursuing the ethnological implications of their dispersion. He undertakes an extended examination of the text of 2 Ezra 13, the man from the sea passage. It is revealed of Manasseh's personality and of the kind of Judaism he represented that he continued to finding his heterodox and mystical text to be the major concern even after his return to rabbinical traditions. The heretical new Christian religiosity was still there beneath the surface. Indeed, we may consider Manasseh to be the last outstanding representative of that quasi-religion of geographical Manasseism, extended all the way back through Columbus and Las Casas to Abraham, Crescas, and Master Jacob of Majorca. It is entirely significant that though learned Orthodox Jews throughout the ages, down to Manasseh's time and beyond, continued to locate descendants of the lost tribes in various parts of the world. Manasseh was the only member of this tradition and the only ordained rabbi ever to place them in America. On this issue, at least, he was not the voice of normative Judaism speaking at all. he looked westward for redemption, as the heretical new Christians had done. Perhaps Manasseh sensed this, and it may have been out of a desire to make a concession to more conventional Jewish ideas than he stressed the presence of the lost tribes in other remote areas as well as America, ready to gather in all corners of the world at the final redemption. But America was his main interest, and all the reports he now proceeded to give confirming the existence of the lost tribes were from the New World, or at least from the southern part of it. For it is striking that this descendant of the Iberian Merinos never betrayed, in his writings at least, any of the interests of the Mongols of the north that his English friends so passionately showed. Now drab and provincial North American natives in their bark wigwams must have seemed to his southern and crypto-converso soul. Only in the southern part of Americas could such a story be heard as the one brought to him as him of a white people with beards and long robes of great wealth and abundant gold, silver and emeralds, who lived in populous walled cities where some Indians, Mongols of the Orinoco, have gone, bringing back with them much treasure. Not that Manasseh settled only for stories of fabulous, however, sometimes the ungainly was what betrayed a possible Jewish presence. You know, they're always peddling in lost cities of the this and that and tremendous riches. A lot of those Spaniards came over, tramped all over the jungle looking for them. Well, look at the water of life, or the well of life, that the one guy looked for all over Florida. Such as a report brought to him from the mountains of Quito, Mendocino's territory, of a white people, tall in stature and well formed, with full-grown beards like Spaniards, very brave, but who do not know how to handle canoes, even though all Indians of that country do not go around any other way. All this evidence is quite persuasive to Manasseh, who nevertheless regrets that it cannot be examined more closely and verified. For a certain Fleming, who once was about to undertake an expedition for this purpose, hired a group of wealthy, interested Jews, died shortly after, apparently because God would not permit such discoveries until the end times. But Manasseh, convinced that the recent Jewish recovery from the long night of suffering under the Spaniards has ethnological significance, assures his reader that they not have long to wait for this event. Well, how do they know that these white guys with beards weren't white guys with beards or Aryans with beards that had traveled to South America way back and become isolated? That makes more sense than the lost fucking tribes of Israel. The publications of his work was received enthusiastically by the left wing of the English Protestantism, both in the Old World and the New, where the inspiration it provided was to extend into the 1670s and 80s among the Quaker founders of the West, New Jersey and Pennsylvania, who were to be the best friends the Indians had yet known among the English colonists. The protector Oliver Cromwell became attracted to Manasseh's views. One wacko with another wacko, which includes the belief that the time had come for a Jewish return to England. On this point, the mystical and the practical came together in Manasseh's spirit, for he urged it not only on the grounds that the Jews had first to be dispersed in all the countries of the world before the final redemption could come, but also because England's growing commercial empire had benefited greatly from Jewish skills. Indeed, it was an empire that the English were not inheriting from the Spaniards, by the way of the Dutch, so why not inherit the services of the Jews as well? Huh, very interesting. Okay. Let's see here. The bid for Jewish entry was rejected, and it disappointed Manasseh, though consoled by Cromwell, with the promise of a yearly stipend of £100, died on his return voyage home. The matter of Jewish entry into England was resolved in the ensuing years, English fashion, by connivance rather than by sweeping official act. Jews quietly snuck in and resettled there, even as early as December 1656. A group of them in London were able, without interference, to rent a house and use it explicitly as a synagogue. By 1664, when an accusation was brought against them that their services were in violation of the year's conventicle act, which permitted only Anglican religious assemblies. See, you can only have one. They only wanted one set of spooks in the sky. The sky was getting too crowded with spooks. And can't have that. Anyhow, and the restored King Charles II himself came to their rescue and took them under his official protection. You see how the big shot and the power people, they will use the Jews, they'll abuse the Jews, and then they'll hug and kiss them, the Jews. It's a game that the rich people play, the ruling class. Jews in England had become an acknowledged fact. But it was King Charles who took him back in, let him stay. And I think he got his head chopped off, didn't he? If he did, he deserved it. Meanwhile, a Jewish presence also made its way into the English colonies, and by the same route from the Iberian persecution over the bridge formed by the Dutch. Here we go with more Jew influence. We may look at the origins of the Jewish community of the future of the United States in the colony of Recife in Brazil, which had been taken by the Dutch from the Portuguese in 1630. Recife was, in terms of economic geography, more a part of the West Indies at this time than part of the South American continent and its Jewish community, which consisted of about 1,000 Jews at its height, some one-third of the total European population there, had become thoroughly integrated into the West Indian economic life. The Jews of Recife, many of whom were Portuguese Murano descent, were in a variety of occupations. But these tended, in one way or another, to be related to the colony's main industry, sugar. Poison. Another poison a white man grabbed. Historians have even suggested that the new Christians were the first to bring sugar to Brazil from Sao Tomé in the Canaries or the Madeiras. In any case, there were Jewish sugar planters in the Dutch Recife. First thing, the Jews start poisoning everybody with sugar. Historians have even suggested that new Christians were the first to bring sugar to Brazil from... Oh, I read that. Okay. These planters owned Negro slaves. See, they bring the poison of sugar to the New World, and then they bring the niggers in to cultivate it. Oh, man. These planters owned Negro slaves just as their Christian counterparts did. In fact, some Jews of the colony found a particular outlet for their commercial talents as brokers in the slave trade. Technically, the trade was a monopoly of the Dutch West Indies Company. There come in the corporate-type outfits. But in practice, the company's ships found it convenient to deposit large consignments of slaves at the port and leave the retailing of them to middlemen rather than sell them directly to the planters. and it was in the intermediate operation that a number of Jews found their mitzvah. Later, when the Jewish communities were established in other parts of the West Indies, some of the members continued to pursue this form of business activity of selling slaves. Selling the niggas! This fact has often caused bewilderment among the observers from a different era. How, they ask, can a people just emerging, and in other places not yet emerging, from centuries of persecution, have so readily become collaborators in the persecution of another people? It's simple, to make money. Follow the money. The answer lies in the appalling truth we have so often had occasion to contemplate in these pages, that black slavery, in which there even were black collaborators in the trade on the African shores, was a matter of conscience for very few men in that epoch. In January 1654, Recife was retaken by the Portuguese, mainly because the Dutch fleet was too preoccupied with the war against the English to be able to defend it, an interesting irony from the standpoint of the Recife Jews, who were to end up living under the British flag as a result. The Portuguese conquerors imposed their usual brand of religious tyranny, tempered by second thoughts and a touch of schlampier, requiring that all Protestants and Jews leave the colony, but giving them 3 months to do so peacefully. The departing Jews were able to find various satisfactory asylums in the New World, and the new, some sailed to the Netherlands. But many stayed closer to their recent home, settling primarily in the West Indies colonies of the Dutch and French, and of the English. One group of 4 men and 6 women and 13 children, however, made it way up to the farthermost north of the Dutch, New World, and in September 1654 arrived aboard the French ship St. Catherine, in the harbor of New Amsterdam, later to become New York. The province of New Netherland, whose government was centered in the village in which 23 Jewish refugees had arrived, was as anomalous among the English colonies on either side of it as it was different from them in nationality. Established in 1623 on the basis of the claim made by Henry Hudson's voyage 14 years earlier, it had none of the continental ambitions and hopes to create a new life, new way of life on earth that now characterized the colonies of both New England and the South. Rather, it was primarily just a collection of trading posts of the Dutch West Indies Company, in one respect a far northern extension of the Caribbean network, in another a counterpart of the French enterprise in Canada, manifested its equivalent in the Cour des Beaux, in some of the adventurous patroons and their comrades in the north. The European population of New Amsterdam in 1654 was no more than about 1,500. The home country of Dutchmen, unlike their Englishmen, was prosperous, relatively untroubled by internal strife, and not so heavily populated as to seem to leave no breathing space for even the only moderately ambitious. Its natives did not surge forth after new horizons. New Netherlands was therefore largely a place for the type of colonist who, whether from Netherlands, France, or England, usually went to the West Indies or Canada, more in search of adventurous profiteering than a new homeland. One result of this New Netherlands was the kind of ease in racial matters that characterized the French and the Canadians with respect to the Indian, and the West Indian planter with respect to the Negro. The Dutch, like everyone else, had their bad moments with the Indians. But on the whole, the race relations among the Hudson were so good that the Dutch friendship with the Iroquois, later inherited by the English, was to turn into a longest-lasting and most powerful European-Indian alliance in all of the Americas. In the matter of black slavery, which flourished more in New Netherland than in any other colony north of Maryland or Virginia, its record also characterized a spirit that seems rather relaxed for the time and place. The slaves who tended to work side by side with whites in a variety of occupations obtained Mamusism with relative ease, whatever that is, mainly through half-freedom status worked out with the West India Company. Now remember, how this is a long time before the Civil War, whereby they could live in effect as free individuals in exchange for certain services and a modest annual tribute. All of this took place in an atmosphere that was unusual cosmopolitan for a New World colony. It was said that 16 different languages could be heard among the settlers in New Amsterdam. In short, one can discern in the Manhattan Island village, in particular, some of the outlines of the future New York, and as such, a likely place for Jewish refugees. Not that the 23 refugees from Brazil were welcomed with open arms. New Amsterdam had tolerated the separate arrivals of two Jewish settlers from Netherlands just a few weeks earlier, but a whole miniature community was another matter. These people have no other god than the mammon of the unrighteous. The New Amsterdam Reverend Johannes Megalopoulos wrote in to his colleagues back home, and no other aim than to get possession of the Christian property, and to overcome all other merchants by drawing all trade towards themselves, the Jews. Therefore, we request your reverence to obtain from Messrs. Directors of the West India Company that these godless rascals, who are of no benefit to the country, but look at everything for their own profit, may be sent away from here. For as we have here Papists, Mennonites, and Lutherans among the Dutch, also many Puritans and Independents, and many atheists, and various other servants of Baal among the English under the government, who conceal themselves under the name of Christians, it would create still greater confusion if the obstinate and immovable Jews came to settle here. They'd just cause more trouble. This at least was not a racial fear, and indeed, after Governor Peter Stuyvesant had sent back to the company in Amsterdam for instructions concerning the refugees, and the latter had settled down to await the reply, Domine Megalopoulos showed that his bark was worse than his bite by helping to tide them over with funds from the Dutch Reformed Church to support the Jews. A response from the company in favor of the refugees probably was inevitable, not only on the moral grounds that the religious toleration was right and had provided or proven its viability in the Netherlands, but on the practical grounds that commercial skills of Jews with connections all over the West Indies could be most useful. That is the main issue, not toleration. Toleration because of the money. Furthermore, what was probably the most important factor of all, there were Jews among the investors in the company. A group of Amsterdam Jewish leaders petitioned the company, urging the refugees be admitted, and the company at length wrote back, quote, "These people may travel and trade to and in New Netherland and live and remain there, provided the poor among them shall not become a burden to the company or to the community, but be supported by their own nation." In other words, you've got to keep a handle on these poor Jews. Don't let these poor Jews get out of line. Thus began a Jewish community life in the future New York, replenished by the arrival of the next few years of more Jewish settlers from the West Indies and Netherlands, and rooted by purchase of communal burial plots, traditionally the first manifestation of an established Jewish community. Disabilities remained, however, for a long time. The Jewish settlers could not buy real estate, bear arms, engage in trade with the Indians, or even in retail trade, nor could they publicly hold religious services. Indeed, the size of the New Amsterdam Jewish community had begun to dwindle under these restrictions by the time of the four historic English men of war arrived in the harbor in August 1664 and took over the colony without firing a shot. But from then on, Jewish life in New York began to flourish, like in London. While the Christian gentlemen looked the other way, by 1700, the Jews of the city were entering into the economic pursuits that had been forbidden them by the Dutch, and were freely worshiping according to their faith in various rented houses. In 1730, organized as Congregation Sherith Israel, the remnant of Israel, they built the first synagogue in North America. By then, there were Jewish communities in other parts of the country as well, in Newport and Philadelphia, in Charleston. Soon there would be one in Savannah, and scattering of individual Jews in all the colonies. It was an English fulfillment, but the way to it had been opened in Amsterdam, old and new, and primarily through the efforts of Manasseh ben Israel and other generations of his generations, who saw themselves as engaging in the final round of a struggle begun by their ancestors in 14th century Spain. They had expected apocalypse and some equivalent to what the Christians were calling the millennium. But when the moment passed, what came instead was a quiet conclusion to a millennium and a half of a Jewish searching for some corner of the world to which to live in relatively peace, equality, and religious freedom. From time to time, men would continue to seek evidence among the Indians of the latter's descent from the lost tribes of Israel. But whatever the ancient history would prove to have been, a latter-day lost tribe at least had assuredly now led the way to an American promised land for themselves and future generations of Jewish refugees from the old world persecution. Of the various racial questions we have dealt with, then it was the Jewish one alone that had found something of a solution in the New World by the end of the 17th century. Indeed, it was for the Jews alone among the racial outsiders that white America, at its inception, represented a fulfillment rather than a violation. This was because within the Dutch and Anglo-Saxon societies that accepted them, above all the latter, which had scarcely known them at all during the four centuries heightening racial consciousness of Christendom, the Jews were little thought of as a race and had become an almost purely religious minority instead. This was a particularly advantage to the North America, which proved to be as amiable to a Jewish present as it was that of any other group of European religious refugees. But in England, as in the New World, religion was an area in which Anglo-Saxon liberalism was prepared to show one of its better sides as the 18th century began. Race was still another matter. We have seen how the English of the 16th and 17th centuries, for all their vaunted notions of being morally superior to the Spaniards, proved not to be so in the domains of race and slavery. The offenses now were to continue even into the age of which better spirits of both sides of the Atlantic would sound their protests against them with growing vehemence. the Indians of North America, whether they had ever been the lost tribes of Israel or not, were at any rate largely to be reduced to the state of lost and wandering people in their own country. In the case of the Negroes, a promised land to white Europeans turned out to be an Egypt that's held them in bondage for more than 200 years, and even the 19th century emancipation hardly turned it overnight into a promised land for the Negroes. Today, at least, we can be reasonably satisfied that the worst excesses of domestic racism are behind us. But we still are a long way from having proven that this country can represent on the level of dignity and mutual respect in no other as just end of the wanderings of all the peoples who have come together on its soils. And so much bullshit there, okay? That's the end of that chapter. Anyhow, you can see how the wanderings of the Christians and the Jews have led to the incorporation of the Jews all over the place and their crazy interpretations of spooks in the sky, which leads them to believe almost anything. That's it for now. Terrible Tommy, maybe that's reading too much, but some of it I think you'll find interesting. 14:5 in five words.